The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. My guest is Chris Franklin. He's CEO of Aqua America, a publicly traded water and wastewater utility holding company with operating subsidiaries serving about 3 million people in 8 states. The company is listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Since joining Aqua America in December 1992, Mr. Franklin has spearheaded several successful projects, including the advocacy for the passage of legislation designed to provide customers of state-regulated water and wastewater utilities with improved water quality and better water and wastewater systems. Chris Franklin, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Nice to be with you today.
Well, nice to have you. And I was saying earlier that water is one of those things that's relevant to all of us and one of the big issues, especially with fairly recent news about Flint, Michigan, and the sale of bottled water that's been going on for quite a while. There's a lot of concern around the state of water quality in U.S. cities and towns. What is your assessment of that? You've got your own service area there, but you travel, you stay in hotels. I don't know if you drink tap water or not. What do you think the state of water quality is in the United States, generally speaking?
It's a great question. You know, Mike, I can't go to a cocktail party anymore without somebody asking me what happened in Flint, Michigan, and could it happen in my community? And so it's on the mind of many Americans. I guess the good news is we think about it from the broadest standpoint. The water quality in the United States is probably among the highest in the world. So we start from a very strong point. But certainly, and coming back to Flint, we have our challenges. But I would say that the challenges in the United States are really around the quality of people who and the quality of the skill set around the treatment, and largely around the infrastructure renewal and replacement. That's the vast gap that exists in the United States as the nation begins to age. We really have deferred maintenance in many, many of our large cities and even middle-sized cities and towns that is going to need renewal, and it's going to be coming upon us very quickly here.
You know, I'm glad you bring that up because there's been so much discussion about infrastructure for years now, and we hear that there's billions of gallons being lost in any given city because of leaky pipes, bad infrastructure. Talk a little bit about the components of water infrastructure, what kind of shape they're in. Obviously, you've already indicated that they're aging and need to be retrofitted. What are the components of water infrastructure, and where's the need most urgent?
Yeah, so let me take you back. You mentioned in your introduction that I came to the company in 1992. And in 1992, the largest subsidiary, it was really the nature of the company at that time for Aqua America, was southeastern Pennsylvania, a large interconnected system. And if we took the miles of main that we were replacing over the total miles of main of the system back then in 1992, we would have been on roughly a 900-year replacement cycle, which by any measure is unacceptable. And that's a really good company. So you can imagine where some of our municipals are. But now since that time, call that 20, 25 years, we have put things in place like legislation that allows us to recover capital in between base rate cases. Those structures have now allowed us to increase our rate of replacement. So over that period of time, we've improved that from 900 years down to just under 100 years, which is really just where you want to be. That's the sweet spot, replacing about 1% of your infrastructure on an annual basis. Much of it, pipe in the ground, has a 100-year life. And that, Mike, is the art of the possible in the United States, right? We really need to focus on infrastructure replacement and getting a cycle time that is acceptable and provides the base for our standard of living and our economy in the United States. And I would call that the underground infrastructure. In terms of plants, think about this. When I joined the company, and just up until a few years ago, really we were measuring contaminants in the water at parts per million. Then we went to parts per billion. Then we went to parts per trillion. And there's now a discussion about ultimately being able to measure parts per quadrillion. As we think about that, that increased technology requires, you know, advanced skill sets, and some of our smaller mid-sized utilities, particularly on the municipal side, don't possess that internal knowledge. And so therefore, when we talk about upgrading our technology, and our infrastructure, it's really what's in the ground, what's in our plants, and then our human infrastructure, our capabilities, and our development in terms of knowledge and training and development of people. So altogether, again, we fortunately in this country started a very strong starting point, good quality water generally, but we want to hold that, and we want to make sure that we're addressing any gaps by addressing the various components I just mentioned.
What do you think about this trend where more and more people drink bottled water, they use Brita, they use, you know, General Electric or some other company's water filters right on the sink? And when traveling, a lot of people don't even drink their own tap water, okay? They filter it. And when traveling, I know personally, a lot of that water doesn't taste very good. It might be only parts per billion or quadrillion, but it doesn't always taste real good. If our water's getting more pure, why are more and more people moving away from it and going to a secondary filtration system?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question to think about. And we look at water across our footprint and beyond, the taste of water is very personal. And what I consider to be very good water, you may consider to be distasteful. There is a baseline, and in fact, we have a lot of our water quality people who are actually trained, and we train our employees to use their nose and their taste to decide what the quality of water is. And hey, just recently, one of our divisions in Illinois, in Kankakee, won a AWWA, or American Water Works Association, taste testing contest. So to your point, there is a standard. A lot of it is personal, but there is a standard. Now, as you get into secondary water quality issues, so let's say this. We pass all state and federal guidelines, and the vast majority of drinking water in this country does that. That's not to say that there's not some discoloration, that there's not some, secondary water quality. It might be slight, moldy taste or algae taste. And that needs to be polished out of the water. And there have been great advances in the company's ability, my company and others, ability to do that through green sand filters and other ways to treat that secondary water quality. But here's one of the challenges. It's one thing if you're in Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, where you have large filtration plants and you're treating sources generally at the same place and at a few places. But in many areas across the country, they have community well systems that serve, call it 50 to 500 people. Those are particularly challenging because now you're tinkering with so many systems that have varying degrees of quality, and it's typically groundwater and not surface water. So we're pulling it from a well that has could have iron or manganese. So now you're treating the water, place by place for smaller groups of people. Very challenging and potentially more expensive. So, here's how I think about bottled water. Certainly, if you're running through an airport, grabbing a bottle of water for the portability of it, hard to beat. But when you think about the standard that bottled water is required to meet and the standard that potable drinking water suppliers like Aqua America are required to meet, I'll tell you what, the standards are much more strict on utilities than they are on bottled drinking water at this point. So from a water quality standpoint, you'd be very safe probably drinking from that tap wherever you are.
Well, isn't it true that some of these bottled water companies, what they do is they put a label that says filtered water, and it might be Aqua America water. They're simply filling bottles. And yeah, it's been filtered. It's Aqua America filtered it, but people end up paying who knows how many times the price for the same water that could come out of the tap.
Well, that's very true. I mean, when you think about us, a penny a gallon delivered to your home, the price isn't even comparable between bottled water and the tap water at your home. Having said that, hopefully we as Americans are starting to move toward renewable or reusable containers for our drinking water. I know in my home we keep bottles in the refrigerator that we reuse, put through the dishwasher and refill with water, and we reuse them all the time. And we've tried to train our children to do that because obviously we're filling landfills with plastic water bottles. So from an pure environmental standpoint too, that there is great challenges with how we're consuming the bottled water.
Yeah, and also some health issues around plastic and such that have been brought up by people. You know, you mentioned water, the taste test that the company won. Does Aqua America or other utilities do anything to actually flavor the water? You're obviously stripping out the impurities. Do you add minerals at all to, well, for instance, like Dasani does in Aquafina, so that you're enhancing the flavor, or is your concern strictly that the water is drinkable and healthful?
Well, we're thinking about on Thursdays adding cherry taste to the water. But I'm kidding.
Good luck with that.
but no, we don't add any taste to it. We consider ourselves purists when it comes to treating and delivering the water. So our job really is to put filtration in place that provides not only the cleanest and purest water, but then the safest, because we put the disinfectant in it, chlorine essentially, to make sure that when that water arrives at your home, that it's safe to drink and it tastes as good as possible.
So you do use chlorine, and that is not, I mean, that's something that sometimes people will say they can taste in the water and they don't like, correct?
That's very true, and I often tell people, if you happen to be closer to a plant where you live, or you happen to be closer to a chlorination station, you know, and you taste that bit of chlorine in your water, it's very easy to fix. Put it in a pitcher, uncovered, put it in the refrigerator, and very quickly that nice chilled water, the chlorine taste dissipates in the air, and it tastes terrific.
Now, you mentioned some of these wells that serve, 50 or 100 households. Isn't it true? My understanding is there's thousands of water districts in the United States. I think the argument's been made that we'd be better served, and I realize I'm talking to the CEO of a publicly traded utility, you probably would have a bit of a bias on this, but that our water systems should be fewer and much larger so that there's more control around the quality of the water and the delivery of that water. Does that ring any bells with you, or am I mistaking water districts for some other utility?
No, I think you're articulating common regulatory policy across the country. In other words, fewer systems, larger systems, which you can bring expertise, you can bring economies of scale, purchasing power, all those sorts of things to water delivery would be much more efficient. And when we think about electric utilities in this country, we wouldn't think about having an electric utility that would serve, 50 to 100 customers. We've got systems all over the place that serve small groups of people. So, no, you're exactly right. Most environmental agencies, call it EPA, most public utility commissions have regionalization or consolidation type policies that encourage these small systems to join larger ones so that they have a better opportunity to ensure higher water quality, more reasonable pricing long term. And so that policy is widely adopted. We've spent the last 20 so years really looking at these and acquiring more than 300 of these smaller water systems. And I would say, in large part, the systems are better run, more efficient. Long term, the rates are reasonable. I don't want to diminish the our municipal brethren, who I think there are a lot of systems that do a very fine job and provide excellent service at an excellent rate. But those that are troubled, those that are smaller and don't have the ability to keep up, their best is to sell their systems to companies like ours. We will pay to the community. And think about this: if you're a mayor and you have to balance your time and your dollars, tax dollars, between, call it, the fire department, police protection, health and human services, you know, street plowing and removal of garbage, versus replacing a length of pipe under the ground that's decaying and breaking, and where are you going to put your time and effort and your dollars? You can't blame a mayor for saying, you know, listen, I can defer that maintenance a little bit longer and underground. Nobody sees it. I get no credit for it. Having said that, if you sell to a company like ours, what we find is we pay for the system. So now a mayor, city council, taxpayers have a pot of dollars that they can apply to any of those other needs, and they have professionals that come in, run the water system, and ensure that the population is receiving clean, clear, and safe drinking water for the duration.
So given that we're seeing climate change and severe droughts in certain parts of the country, I'm sure you have an opinion on maybe what should be a national strategy for meeting this challenge.
Yeah, most certainly, as we think about capacity, and, you know, I think for Aqua America and the 8 states where we do business, we're blessed that we don't have capacity challenges, particularly in the Northeast, where we have reservoirs developed by those who have come long before us. Our company's 130 years old, and so we've got long-standing reservoirs and impoundments where we hold water. But in areas that are more arid and challenged, I mean, we just came through the drought of a lifetime in California. Texas, if you looked around Austin a few years ago, Lake Travis was almost entirely dry. So even in Lake Lanier in Atlanta, there were challenges down there as that lake all but dried up a number of years ago. Now, they've all come back, but to your point, as we see global climate change, you know, how long will it take for those to come back, and the planning that needs to be in place so that we keep people in water, even in the most challenged areas, is very, very important. Now, I think as an experiment, a forced experiment, if you will, when Governor Brown in California called for the reduction in water consumption of about 25%, they actually saw water consumption come down even more than that. So people do respond when they're asked to conserve water. You know, in that case, it was an imperative, but they do respond. And I think what you'll find in California, only time will tell, but I think what you'll find is that people have moved to what I would call xscaping, right? Instead of landscaping, they've got landscaping that goes more with the climate, and they don't need to put thousands of gallons of water on their green grass to keep it green all year long. Now it's more to the climate, and that water consumption in many cases will never return, which in California is a very good thing.
Yeah, you know, that's there's a lot of shortages we can tolerate. Water is not one of them, and you know, our companies in California, it got scary there for a while because the water was just the drought was just carrying on and on. And so not surprising that people responded in such a big way, knowing that it's such a essential a natural resource. Let's talk for a minute about what about desalination? Do you have a position on desalination? Because that's one of the sources of potable water that we could turn to if these droughts persist or even get worse. What do you think about, has your company given any consideration to that, or do you have such prolific water sources that you haven't needed to think about it?
Yeah, in our footprint, we haven't needed to move toward desalinization, but I will say that the technology continues to develop, and in areas where they are applying it, it is working. The power to operate a desalination plant is expensive. Having said that, think about this. 40% of the world's population lives within 100 kilometers of a coastline. And you know, as the population of the world continues to increase, and you have 1% of the world's water is potable. So think about that. We're going to have no choice but to treat brackish and salt water to keep our populations in the water they need to survive. So your point is right on. That technology needs to continue to develop, and it really is developing at a strong pace. I will say our ability to use membrane treatment and reverse osmosis to treat brackish water has really come a long way, and that's going to be a reality, because as you think about the salt lines in many of our rivers moving up from the sea up further and further into the populated centers, you know, that that ability to treat brackish water and turn it into clean water. Even when you think about the swampy areas in much of Florida, the ability to treat that brackish water and make it potable is vitally important. And to be able to do it in a cost-effective way is really the focus of the technological development.
Are there other water technologies that are in development right now, or maybe recently came to market or are coming to market, that you would point to that you are excited about?
Yeah, I mentioned one other, which is the approach where we're spending a lot of time on this secondary water quality, because you touched on it earlier as well, that as we travel, the quality of water we may taste in certain areas may not be what we are used to, or may not be what we like. And so to polish some of that out, we're really developing technologies to help us in the filtration of some of those secondary water quality issues. You know, you may have been in a place where the ring around your toilet, that manganese, kind of the purplish blackish ring in the toilet, those are things that can be polished out of water now and done with current technology. The other technology that I think is important, we think about lost water and how we measure water that leaves our plant but never reaches a human being or a fire, or its ultimate destination is not reached because it's lost from broken mains or other reasons. And so the technology in metering and sensors to pick up lost water between the plant and the ultimate destination of the customer is really developing. We spend a lot of time for all, I think, good reasons. Obviously, environmental is one of them, but profit is another, right? To drop down our cost. So we try to drop that. The American Water Works Association talks about an 18% target, 18% water loss. You know, you should be in that range. And we do very well against that measure. But there are certainly systems around the country that we've encountered that are losing, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60% of their water. And so to the degree that we can develop technologies that sense that water loss and can send signals to operators to fix main breaks that may be leaking straight down into the ground as opposed to shooting up in the air, and then we can fix those and drop that lost water, all the better. So those are some areas that I think are really developing technology, and in the coming years we'll see some advances.
What about the billions of gallons that are being lost right now in lieu of this technology, or this technology not having been deployed yet in certain metropolitan areas? I've long wondered, does that create an aquifer under, say, especially a dense city, say a San Francisco or New York, if you have leaky pipes and billions of gallons are being lost, does it create an aquifer that could actually be tapped and pumped?
Not that I've ever seen it. A lot of that would depend on the formation underneath of a city or a particular area, where that water ultimately ends up. If there's rivers or underground passageways that would take that water elsewhere. So I've not heard of a cavern that was being filled that could later be tapped and pumped. Interesting thought, but I've not heard of that happening. We do see, though, as we look across our platform, it's interesting to think about when we talk about consumption of water on the other side of it. We have long records because our company is so old. So water consumption on a per capita basis, peaked in 1971. And this isn't unique in, call it, Philadelphia or Ohio. We see it in Illinois. But it peaked in the early 70s. And ever since that time, if you annualize it, it would look like a 1% drop in consumption ever since 1971. So people are using less water, and so creating a little bit more capacity in the system. But the amazing thing is we've not seen it stop even yet. So as you put new washing machines, clothes washers, dishwashers, people use water more efficiently, shower heads, toilets, it is actually working, and consumption on a per capita basis or on a per meter basis has been declining now for decades.
Interesting. So other than your service area, Chris, could you cite a community or two that you think is setting the standard for water quality and management? That would include maybe the infrastructure, where they've really done the spending that was necessary to upgrade the infrastructure and retain that water. Is there maybe a municipality or two outside your area that you would point to and say, these people are doing it right?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the other publicly traded companies in our water world, I think they're all doing it in similar fashion to us. We're probably installing or replacing at the fastest pace. For example, we'll do 150 miles of main replacement just this year alone. But I think if you look across those investor-owned companies who are typically under more stringent requirements, environmental requirements, than some of our municipal counterparts, they're the companies that are really making the infrastructure improvements and investments. And I would point to those as shining examples. One of the things that we talk about at our National Association meetings is creating a standard for membership that would suggest that, you know, companies that would join the association would meet certain replacement cycles, certain service standards that would be required even to enter membership. And that's the kind of the level that we're all thinking about. And I'm not sure if you're doing multiple services every day that you're able to think in terms of setting bars that an industry should meet and exceed in order to be members. I mean, remember, if you're San Antonio or you're Los Angeles, these are big systems, great professionals with very large knowledge, very similar to what we would have at this company. Maybe a little less ability to raise capital, but great expertise. As you get into smaller cities and towns, they're really constrained and challenged.
My guest has been Chris Franklin. He's CEO of Aqua America, a publicly traded water and wastewater utility holding company that ultimately serves 3 million people in 8 states, and you can find the company on the New York Stock Exchange. Chris, really interesting discussion. I appreciate you taking the time.
Mike, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.